Hi, my name is Martin Purnell and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email ogc@accessradio.biz. Biz is spelled B-I-Z and that's ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who is an author, educator, and inspirational speaker. She won the ACW Award for Outstanding Contribution to Christian Publishing in 2018. She has a series of books entitled 30 Days With, which include David, Esther, Ruth, and John. For someone in her teens that loved music and sport, to then discover she had a serious illness is one thing. To become completely deaf at the age of 21 is another. Our guest's book, entitled My Diary, written as if we had borrowed her own personal journal, covers topics such as self-image, self-worth, loss, faith, and mental health. So, what exactly is neurofibromatosis? What does she remember feelings-wise when being told of her illness? What does she mean when she said, and I quote, "I realized what silence means, what it actually means, not what my hearing self of yesterday had imagined it might mean." Was there a grieving process when she lost her hearing? How much does she want to blame God? What has she learned about herself from all her books she has written? So many questions, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off Grid Christianity, Emily Owen. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today. And for those that are saying, well, if she's deaf, how can she answer all your questions, Martin? Well, good old Google. They've got closed caption and it works smoothly, if that's the right word. Where are we speaking to you from, please?
Well, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here. I am speaking from Leicester.
Well, thank you, Emily, and also for your immense patience with me last month when we were supposed to be recording this. And as you know, everything that could possibly go wrong with technology went wrong. And so we spent 2 hours of me going testing 1, 2, 1, 2. So it's great to have you back and my technology is working. But to find out more about you, apart from living in Leicester, 5 maybe not so important questions. Let's see how you get on, Emily. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. Question number 1. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
I think it would have to be Jane Austen, actually. I would really be interested to sit down and have a chat with Jane Austen, partly because I really like her books. And partly because I think it's really interesting that people are now writing about the characters that she created. And I would love to know what she thinks about that, what she thinks of all these spin-offs.
Yes, that's very good. What do you actually know about Jane Austen?
What do I know about Jane Austen? Well, she's a very good writer. She's very observant. She's very witty. I think she's someone who knew her own mind. And yeah, I just, I think she's great.
Am I right in saying that she died fairly young?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think she did. But she still managed to write so much and so many good books. So, yeah, I would really love to sit down and have a chat with her.
Well, that's a very good answer. And, of course, if you did and you had to cook a meal, what kind of meal would you cook her, do you think?
I wouldn't be cooking it. I'd be ordering a takeaway.
Well, that'd be interesting.
I don't want to poison Jane.
Well, that'd be very interesting because I don't think takeaways were available round about the 1800s, were they?
I would introduce them to her.
That's a whole new concept, isn't it? Well, this is Chinese food. Well, what's that? Well, it's from China. Yes, I gather that she'd say, make some sort of witty retort. But yes, there'd be so many foodstuffs that she would not be aware of. That's fantastic.
Actually, I think what we'd mainly do is just drink tea. That would be fine.
Tea and scones.
Yes, exactly.
Question 2. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please?
You do realise these questions are really tricky, don't you? But actually, I do have a favourite Bible character who I think is Barnabas.
Oh, really?
Paul's friend, Barnabas. Because what I really like is that Barnabas is an encourager. When we first read about Barnabas, it's just Barnabas. Then it becomes Barnabas and Paul. Then it becomes Paul and Barnabas. Then it just becomes Paul. Almost as though Barnabas is just there encouraging things. And I think that's a really good way to be. In fact, I have lots of Barnabases in my own life, people who encourage me.
Oh, that's good. So give a shout out then, maybe not literally name somebody, but give us a shout out as to how you've been encouraged in the past.
Well, there's all sorts of different ways. Obviously, being deaf, people who are willing to take time to communicate with me, that's really encouraging. People who say, oh, actually, I've read your book, that's really encouraging. People who notice that I need a light switching on because it's too dark for me to lip read, that's really encouraging. Just loads and loads of people who help me out in what are apparently little ways, but they're not little at all.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What about then, Emily? You're in a room with somebody, and obviously you can lip read, but how important is it for you now, whereby you have, like we're using here, closed caption, whereby you can get software on your phone, and somebody could actually speak into their phone to talk to you, and you're only like 5 foot away, but you're using each other's phones so you can read what they're saying?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, interestingly, I was out for lunch on Saturday with friends who, many of whom are also deaf, and they were using this caption on their phone. I don't usually use it when I go out for dinner, but they had it and it was great. People could just pick up what was being said.
Yeah.
Generally, I would lip read, but obviously in a phone call, I can't lip read.
No.
So the captions are really helpful for that kind of thing. I'm plucking up courage to use them more. I'm beginning to trust them.
Yeah. That's really good. You know, for all those people out there saying, oh, the internet is really bad, it's really wicked and everything else like that. You get that in every walk of life, unfortunately, and something has to be done about it. But here's a really positive thing here.
Yeah.
And hats off to all those software manufacturers.
I am not very good at technology myself, but I love technology because it really helps me in my life. You could almost say it's a Barnabas for me.
Well, it's good, yes. In fact, there you go. If I ever become a software manufacturer, I'm going to call it Barnabas. There you go. Sold. Question three. This is going to be very interesting, Emily, for your answer on this one. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted that I'm not Prime Minister, even for a day. I would not like that job. I would really love to say something really inspiring now and have some really radical thing that I would implement. But actually, I think the law I would implement is be kind. I think if everyone was kind, wouldn't life be so much better? Be nice. Think about other people. Yeah, they do unto others as you would have them do to yourself. And that kind of thing. Every single time we were behaving to others as we would behave to ourselves, I think the world would be a much better place.
Very good answer. You could just see it there. If some rapscallion was in court under your be kind rule, and he could say to the judge, don't send me away for 20 years, Governor. Leave it out. Be kind to me. You know, you could then have that kind of banter across as well, couldn't you?
Well, exactly. That's the thing. But probably if he had followed the be kind rule, he would never have been in court in the first place.
You see, you are a politician. That was very quick. A very good answer. Thank you. I can see you becoming the next Prime Minister after that answer. Thank you, Emily. And just think of all the things that come your way as a result. You could go see Taylor Swift in concert for a start. Moving on.
Well, you know, to be honest, it's almost worth it just for that.
No, it's not. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Well, I actually have quite a few enjoyable days out. Pretty much any day I spend with friends is enjoyable. But if the one that really springs to mind, I would say, is a few years ago now, I was on holiday with friends in Scotland. And one of them said, oh, I've got a canoe. Shall we go out on the water? And I thought, well, I'll watch. And she said, no, I think you'd really like it. But I'm quite a nervous person with that kind of thing. So I wasn't sure. But she persuaded me. And the two of us paddled out on this loch. And there was no one to be seen. Beautiful scenery. And that is just a really special memory for me.
Yes.
Particularly, possibly, because she got cancer and she died. And I've always got that memory of a special time with her. So that's one of my special memories of a happy day.
Lovely, lovely. What was your friend's name?
Teresa.
Lovely answer. Thank you very much indeed. Question five, on the other side of the coin, what has been your most embarrassing moment, please, Emily?
Well, this one is interesting. If I asked my family, I think they would say, where would you start? I have a lot of embarrassing moments, partly many of them are actually due to things like lip reading.
Yes.
Because I make so many mistakes and get the wrong end of the stick. And that can be quite embarrassing. But I'm not going to go into any of them.
Boom.
But one time that was quite embarrassing. It was embarrassing looking back because at the time, it all just happened so quickly that I didn't have time to be embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah.
It was when I was in St Pancras boarding a train to come back up to Leicester. And when I walk, I need crutches because my balance isn't very good. And I reached up to get onto the train and hold onto the handle of the train, you know, yeah. when you step on. And I was holding the handle of the train with the crutch on my arm. And the crutch slipped off my arm in that split second when I was boarding the train. And it fell off my arm. And it didn't stay on the platform. It fell down the crack between the train and the platform.
Oh, no.
And landed on the track. And this train was due to pull out in about 30 seconds, literally. I was rushing to get the train in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
So I grabbed someone who worked there. He got a grabber and handed me the crutch and I got on the train. Looking back, that's quite an embarrassing situation. But at the time, it just had to be dealt with.
And you did.
Yeah, that was quite embarrassing.
Yeah, but you did though. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what's also really good are the people around who are prepared to help out.
Exactly. I always find people are prepared to help. I am surrounded by Barnabases.
Yeah.
Seriously. People are so kind and helpful. Yeah.
Brilliant.
So it's great.
Well, that's a really good happy ending on that one. And I just feel now that today's podcast is going to be a Barnabas podcast. We're going to feel very encouraged by the end of it and through it as well.
Well, hopefully.
Absolutely. Well, let's go for it then. So first of all, before we look into your writing process and everything else like that, a little birdie tells me that you're off for a photo shoot this afternoon. What's all that about?
I am off to a photo shoot. And photos are probably one of my least favourite things. I don't really like having my photo taken, which I'm imagining will come to. But the reason this photo shoot came about is because my last photo shoot was probably about 5 years ago, and I've just been recycling those photos. And recently, someone said to me, they want to do an article on me, and they said, can you send us a photo? But they said, not that one of you in the green top. And I thought, that tells me that one photo that I recycle has had its day. So I'm going to have photos taken that are not of me in the green top. And I know at least one person will be delighted because it's not the one of me in the green top. So, yes, I have this photo shoot.
Well, here's the thing then, because as you're most probably aware on our podcast, whilst it's only audio, I do have to have a picture for the software so it can be uploaded. If you could send me a photo that I can use for our publicity purposes, people, when they look at your photo, will know whether it's the current one or the old one because of a green top. So if you could send me one later on, that'd be great.
That's true, actually. Very sneaky of you, very sneaky.
Thank you. Well, let's go for it then. Enjoy your photo shoot and let's find out more about yourself, if that's right, Emily. Neurofibromatosis. For those that don't know what it actually is, what is neurofibromatosis, please, Emily?
Well, first of all, it's a condition that's very hard to pronounce.
Mm.
It took me a long time to learn to say it, even longer to learn to spell it. But basically, what it means is that I grow benign tumours on nerves all over my body. They pop up anywhere and can be quite serious if not dealt with.
So how do they deal with it? And how do you deal with it?
Well, how they deal with it is often, in my case, surgery. Increasingly, there is drug therapy that's available, but for me, that's never worked, largely because my tumours grow too quickly. So when I was diagnosed, I was 16 years old. And at that time, when they actually found these brain tumours, they particularly found the ones in my brain, they were so big that the doctor said, if we don't operate, these tumours will kill you. So, yes, for me, drug therapy wasn't really an option. Surgery was the only option.
Wow.
But before I was 16, I'd never heard of neurofibromatosis. Never heard of it.
How long was the operation then, Emily?
They decided to remove one tumour first, and that operation was, I think it was just over 12 hours long.
Wow.
So, yes, a long time.
And what do you remember of that time?
Actually, I remember going for the surgery, and as I say, I was 16 years old. Mm. And I thought, well, brain surgery, I was actually quite blasé about it. I don't know why, but I thought, oh yes, 12 hours in surgery, 10 days in hospital, then I'll be back doing my A-levels. That was my plan.
Very good plan.
Yeah, I like having plans. But my plans don't always happen. In fact, they often don't happen.
Yeah.
And in this case, they didn't happen because I had the surgery and it went well. But the following day, I lost consciousness and they rushed me back into theatre. And they said, you know, fluid had built up on my brain and they released that fluid, but I still didn't wake up. So they put me in intensive care, did a further surgery on my 17th birthday. I still didn't wake up. So they put me back in intensive care. And after 5 days in intensive care, they said to my parents, well, they asked for their permission to switch off the life support machine because I wasn't going to make it. My parents said yes, because that was the advice of the medics and because they knew that I had faith as well. So they knew that where I was going, that I would be with Jesus. But no one listening will be at all surprised to realise that the machine was not switched off because I'm here talking.
Yes.
Yes. So, yeah, Eureka.
Yeah.
No, but they realised I might have a chance of living.
That's what's called a plot spoiler, that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's a plot spoiler. I'm still here, alive and kicking. Had a long road to recovery after that.
But hang on, Emily. If your parents reluctantly but trusted the medical profession to switch the machines off, why weren't the machines switched off?
Well, it literally got to the point where the medics were at the bed, literally about to switch the machine off. And then one of them realised, and I don't know how they realised this, I'm not a medic, they realised that actually there was a chance that I could live, a chance that I could breathe for myself. So they left the machine on, but they said to my parents, if she's going to have any chance of living, she's going to need to learn to breathe for herself because the machine was breathing for me. I was basically like a vegetable. I could do nothing. The machine breathed for me. And they said, if she's going to learn to breathe, you're going to have to tell her. Because remember, I could still hear in one ear. I was deaf in one ear at this point from the surgery.
Right.
So my dad sat by my bed in intensive care and he literally said, breathe, breathe, breathe. And if I heard him say breathe, I took a breath. But if he didn't say it, I didn't bother breathing and the machine did it. So my dad sat there for a long time teaching me to breathe. And eventually I was able to come off the life support machine.
So how long did your dad stay there for saying that word breathe?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I think it was hours. Yeah. You can see I'm a very obedient daughter. I did what he told me to do.
That particular occasion, definitely, I would have thought. And what about that medic? That medic who just looked at something or other that made him think, hang on a minute, or she think, there's something here.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible, really. As I say, I don't know what they saw, but they saw something.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Wow. Well, that was 5 days into your 10-day plan. How many days was it before you actually were able to leave the hospital and go back to school?
This 10-day plan, the 10-day plan, for 10 days I was in intensive care and then I was moved to a ward and I wasn't able to leave hospital for 3 months.
Wow.
So yes, my plan didn't happen.
And in those 3 months, what were they training you to do, besides from breathing, obviously?
Well, I was learning to eat, to walk, to talk, to move, to sit. Literally, I was learning everything. I was learning to remember. I mean, my short-term memory had completely disappeared in the surgery. So, yes, I was learning to do everything.
Wow. And then you went eventually back to school and life was a breeze, I would have thought, after all that, until, of course, you then realised that actually maybe your other ear, the hearing loss was getting worse and worse. What do you remember of that time?
Well, the hearing in one ear was perfect. And yes, so I went back to college and did my A-levels. And as you say, life was a breeze, except it wasn't.
No.
Because things were a struggle. As I say, my memory had gone and it was hard for me to study.
Yeah.
But I carried on. I got my A-levels, went to university to do English. And halfway through my first year, I was told that the brain tumour they removed had grown back really big. So they had to offer it again, but this time they said they were going to take every single bit of that tumour, because the first time I found out they'd left about a millimetre of it, because that millimetre was attached to my facial nerve. And they said, if we operate, it's likely that your facial nerve will be damaged.
Yeah.
So obviously I prayed that this wouldn't happen, but when I woke up from that surgery, they'd removed all the tumour. That was the good news. They damaged my facial nerve, which was not the good news.
No.
So we can see why I'm not very keen on photo shoots.
Yes. Yeah. You said you had faith before going in for the operation. And as you know, this podcast series is called Off-Grid Christianity, because I am very concerned about the state of the world now, because people seem to be making a commitment to Jesus, and then eventually, through whatever reason, they decide to sort of, no, I can't be bothered anymore. And eventually their faith whittles down to zero. So where was your faith in all these months and a couple of years, you know, immediately after the operation?
My faith was terrified. It was there, but it was terrified because I didn't know what was happening. And I was terrified. And in a sense, my faith was a kind of, I'm so scared that I can't ignore God. God has to be there with me, because I reached that point of terror that God was the only thing that I could hold on to.
Mm.
And so I did. I would say God was with me, and that meant the world. For example, when I lost my face, but when my facial nerve was damaged and I could no longer smile, I looked different. Everything had changed. I got very depressed. I got very low. I wouldn't leave the house. Didn't want anyone to see me. Didn't even want God to see me. But God stayed. And for me, that was huge. I wouldn't have stayed with me. You know, the damage that I saw in myself was so big that I wouldn't have stayed. But God stayed. And that is what I learned, even though I'd had faith ever since a very small child. I've never really experienced a God who truly does not walk out when things are hard.
See, you said something very poignant there, because my wife, who's been through a different circumstance regarding several illnesses like yourself, but she has told me many a time that when she was alone, all she had was God. I find it very difficult for people to actually put that into words as to how you know God is there. But because you've done your English, and because you're a motivational speaker, putting the ball into your court here, how would you describe what it's like to know that God is there in your darkest hours?
Well, I'm just going to jump a little bit further forward in my story in order to answer that. Because after this, where I had that surgery, that I was very low, you know, after my facial nerve was damaged.
Yeah.
And then I did gradually begin to get confidence back to go out. I did voluntary things. I went back to church. I did various things. And then when I was 21, so that's 2 years later, my tumour on the other side, the side that could still hear, it grew so big that, as I say, the doctor said, it's going to kill you unless we operate.
Mm-hmm.
Their literal words were, either we operate and you lose your hearing, or we don't operate and you lose your life. Not much of a choice, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But that was what they said. So I had to have this operation, you know, that was going to leave me totally deaf. And I can remember leaving the hospital. By this time, I was at a hospital in Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us probably know that in Manchester, it always rains. I have never been to Manchester when it is not raining. So I walked out.
I have.
So I walked out of the hospital. Oh, have you?
Yeah.
So I walked out of the hospital and it was raining. And I saw a rainbow in the sky. And, you know, I registered it. And it was just, it gave me a bit of a lift, because I just had this terrible news that soon I would be deaf.
Mm.
And I saw this rainbow and it gave me a bit of hope. And then in the car, all the way back down to Leicester, it rained, but there was rainbow after rainbow after rainbow. Yeah. Literally, I've never seen that kind of thing before. So many rainbows. And in the Bible, the rainbow is a sign of God's promise that God is there. I thought, that's God reminding me that he is with me, even when it's raining, even when it's hard, And I decided that day that I was going to look for rainbows. I don't mean it rains everywhere I go. I decided I was going to look for joy in every day, something that was good, not ignoring all the rain and the hard stuff, but finding something good. And I still do it. All these years later, I still look for joy, but it can be anything. It can be chocolate, you know, chocolate. That's a moment of joy.
Yeah.
It can be meeting a friend. That's a moment of joy. It can be, to be honest, sometimes it can just be a comfy pillow in hospital. That is a little bit of joy. And as I looked for these things, I learned to recognize that God had sent them. And I learned to recognize God with me in everything. So I don't know if that answers your question. If it doesn't, come back to me. But for me, it's about recognizing God in every aspect of life.
Well, to summarize then, the question would be, how much did you want to blame God? In a summary, you would say what?
Well, zero.
Yeah.
I never wanted to blame God. To be honest, it never occurred to me to blame God, because why would it? I suppose there was a time when I did have a fleeting, why is this happening to me?
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately, the answer flicked back to me, well, why not you? Why not you? And I thought, well, actually, that's true. Why shouldn't it happen to me? You know, I'm not some sort of magical protector. There's nothing special about me. Why shouldn't it happen to me? And for me, that kind of helped to rationalize in terms of this question of why. But I never blamed God. I did question whether God would want to bother with me. As I say, I've always had a relationship with him. And I've played the piano in various church groups, and I've always been doing things with God. But then I reached the point when I couldn't do anything except lie in bed in hospital. And I did think, why would God want to bother with me? God showed me, well, at that time, he showed me that I didn't have to do anything for him to bother with me. He bothers with me just because I'm here. And I found that really hard to get my head round, I have to say. God said to me, and this is when I was lying in hospital one time, and it was actually on a Sunday morning. I can remember it was Sunday morning, about 4 a.m., because the light had shone through the cracks in the curtains and woken me up. And I thought, I really want to go to church today. And as I looked at myself in the bed, my legs didn't move. I'd had surgery on a tumour on my back, which had left me paralysed. And my legs didn't move. I was attached to all sorts of drips. But I thought to myself, you know, I really want to go to church. I'm sure I can just manage to make those legs move, get out of bed, walk, jump in a taxi, go to church. This was my plan. And as I say, my plans often don't happen. Needless to say, that plan didn't happen. But as I was lying there, I was thinking, but if I do go to church, why would God want my worship? Why would he want mine? You know, my life is completely scuppered.
Mm.
By this stage, I couldn't hear. I couldn't walk. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. And I just thought, if I do go, why would God want my worship? God said to me, Emily, he said, what's the biggest act of worship in the Bible? So I went through some of the stories in my mind that I'd learned in Sunday school, things like Daniel, Moses, Samson, all these stories I went through. And I went through the Bible in my mind. And I came to Jesus and all the acts of worship, you know, all the way Jesus glorified God, because that's what worship is, making God happy. I didn't think I made God happy, so I didn't think I could worship. But I was going through all these things. When I came to Jesus on the cross, God said to me, stop. Just stop there. God helped me to understand that Jesus on the cross, doing exactly what God wanted him to do, being where God wanted him to be, was an act of worship. And Jesus was still on the cross. He couldn't move. He couldn't do anything. And that really resonated with my situation of lying in that bed. I couldn't do anything. And God said to me, yeah, but inside you can still be who I want you to be. I've really held on to that, because when my life changed, I was this damaged person that couldn't hear, couldn't walk, couldn't smile. Identity became really important to me. You know, it's like, well, who am I now? And God showed me and patiently shows me again and again that inside I am still me. I am still the person he wants me to be. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. And I thank you for it. And I want to take it a little bit further. So please forgive me. I'm not deliberately trying to catch you out here at all. But I'm pretty sure that the number one question you would get from people when you're speaking on this subject, especially from people who haven't got a faith or have lost their faith, the number one question would be, yeah, but if you say God is a loving God, why would he let you have those illnesses in the first place? So what would you give as a response to that?
I would say, why do you need to know that?
Ooh.
I think I would, because I've learned, I mean, actually, to be fair, I probably wouldn't say that, but it's a question I would ask in the conversation.
Yes.
Not immediately hit people with it, but just because of my own experience, that's something I've learned to do, to let go of the whys, because I don't actually need to know why God would allow it. You know, why do I need to know that? How does it help me to wrestle with that question, which, let's face it, is unanswerable? So many better minds than mine have wrestled with that question and no one has come up with an answer. So for me, it's about realizing that I don't need to know why, that I can leave it with God. For me, learning not to need to know the answers is a big release.
Can I just say that is an amazing answer? And I go back to what I said to you about 20 minutes ago. You need to become a politician, because it was not just a brilliant answer, but the way you immediately batted it back to me as if you were a cricket batsman. I'm going to ask you, why do you need to know the answer? Brilliant. It starts here.
It starts here.
Emily for Prime Minister.
I should just point out, do not ask me to hit a cricket ball because I would miss.
Let's go on to sunnier climes, if that's okay. Obviously, it's going to be dispersed with loads of rainbows, no doubt, as well, because you are a positive person. And you've got a great way with words as well, explaining in a loving way as to what you've been through. Before we do that, one final thing about your mum and dad, especially as your dad being in a hospital. And I said to him, what do you remember that time? What do you think he would say?
That's really interesting. What do I think he'd say? I think he'd say, I remember driving backwards and forwards from the hospital every day, because that was a journey that we joke that in the end, the car knew its own way to the hospital, because he made that journey a lot. I honestly don't know what he'd say. I wonder whether he might say, actually, he probably wouldn't say very much at all, but I think he, being a man, he might say, actually, being told that I could sit and say, breathe, 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 was great, because it was something that I could do to help. You know, I imagine he might have felt quite helpless, but here was them saying to him, this is something you can do to help.
Wow.
So he might say that.
And of course, it all boils down to as well, just don't give up, really, doesn't it? And he didn't.
Yeah.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, so there you are. You're back at university doing your English, and then one thing leads to another. What made you write your first book? What was all that about?
I should just point out at this point, I didn't get my degree, didn't get my English degree. I had this surgery during the first semester, and when my face was damaged, I just did not have the confidence to go back. So I didn't get the degree. But you can realise from my degree choice that I really loved text and reading and writing essays about it and pulling it apart. But one thing I never thought I'd do was write. It literally didn't occur to me that I would write books. But time went on, and I have had lots and lots of surgeries. Hospital is my second home. I have had more than 20 surgeries and counting. In fact, just last Tuesday, I was talking to a surgeon and we've booked me in for my next surgery. I do talk about rainbows and finding joy, and it's really important to me. But it's really important to say that that doesn't mean my life is sorted. I still have this ongoing thing, ongoing surgeries, ongoing tumours, ongoing condition. So, you know, I'm not some sort of Pollyanna, although my younger sister is actually called Pollyanna, but I'm not, you know, a Pollyanna, everything's fine. But I do try to balance joy with the hard stuff. But yes, so in terms of writing, this would be a few years after I didn't get my degree. I was in hospital and I'd had surgery, and I was lying there in bed, and it was just before Christmas. Well, I don't know whether anybody else feels like this, but I was feeling, I knew God was there, but I felt like I wasn't very close to him.
Yep.
I felt quite distant from him, and I wanted to be closer, but I just couldn't somehow bridge that gap. I was still praying. I was still talking. That's something that I have learned in my life, that even when I don't feel close to God, even when I'm unsure of things, still talk to him. Still talk to him, because people sometimes think, oh, you know, what do I do when things are so difficult? And I say, well, tell God. Sometimes my prayer is literally, I hate this. I say it to God, I hate this. And so often the answer comes back, I do too. And that is really encouraging, because God, he doesn't like it when we go through hard times. He doesn't like that at all. And I find it encouraging that he says to me, I don't like it either. He might not say, I'm going to fix it, I'm going to sort it, I'm going to do what you want, but he gets it. He gets it. We always have someone who gets it. So in the hospital bed, I was lying there and I was saying to him, I really would like a book that I can read every day, that's a devotional book,
yeah,
that is engaging and challenging and doable. By that I mean that I'm not going to sit reading for 3 hours every day. You know, a short, punchy, engaging, challenging, doable book, a Christian book, a devotional book, Bible-based. And I said, but every time I've been into a Christian bookshop, I've never quite seen what I'm looking for. And that was when God said, well, you'd better write it then. I came out of hospital and I was still fairly weak, couldn't really do much, but I could sit at my desk and tough away with two fingers at my computer. And so I started writing this book. That was the beginning of my writing journey.
I'm not trying to be negative here at all. I'm just trying to build a big picture to encourage those, because the answers you've given so far have been more than just encouraging. In light of what you said, and God said that, but me too, you know, I don't like you being here as well. There must be people who have said, yeah, well, hang on a minute. I thought God was in the place of healing and he's healed others. Why can't he heal you? So how would you respond as a politician now? You're allowed to say what you want. How would you respond to that?
Well, I have no idea. I think a politician would probably swerve the question. But I'm not going to swerve the question. If people said to me, why can't God heal you? I would say, well, he can. I do believe he can. I believe right now he could heal me. I believe that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly he hasn't healed me. Why hasn't he healed me? Again, I've come to a place when I'm okay with not knowing why he's not healed me. Would I like him to heal me? Well, it would be rather nice, wouldn't it? I would love to be able to hear. But obviously I can't hear. I believe he could heal me. I know he hasn't healed me. I don't need to know why he hasn't healed me. Because if I go down that rabbit hole of why, I think I'm going to get stuck in that rabbit hole. And personally, I don't want to be stuck in a rabbit hole of why, when there are no answers, because I don't know. I'm okay with not knowing.
Brilliant answer. Seriously, I wish you'd become a politician. You'd be superb. There you go. As I said about 10 minutes ago, Emily for Prime Minister starts here. So you've got to go for it. I love your answers. I love your honesty. And I love the way you explain it as well. You start to write your first book. What was that actual book called, Emily?
The very first book I wrote was actually called Mary's Diary. And it was an Advent book that I wrote of daily readings, 25 daily readings. Mary's Diary will probably not be available if you Google it. It might be, I don't know. But the reason being, I very naively wrote this book thinking, oh yes, publishers are going to snap it up.
Yeah.
And so I sent it off to publishers and awaited the offers that would come in. But the emails came back saying, we can't publish this.
Why not?
I thought, well, if the answer had just been we can't publish it, I would have probably said, okay, that's fine, I'll leave it. But they all said we can't publish it, but we really like the material. So I thought, well, that's a bit strange. You can't publish it, but you like the material. So I thought, well, in that case, I'll publish it myself. I'll get it printed. and I'll see, I'll test the market. So I got it printed, went into shops and people and said, do you want to sell this book? And they said, we'll put it on our shelves. But then they started emailing me saying, we've sold out. Can you give us more copies? Bearing in mind, this is quite a small sphere because I don't have loads and loads of contacts. But anyway, on the back of that, publishers did get interested. That book has now been published by a traditional publisher, but it's renamed 30 Days with Mary. So it's the essential material for my very first book, but it's got a different title.
And you had to write another 5 days worth as well.
I had to write another 5 days. Yeah, you're a good mathematician. Well worked out.
That's brilliant. What was the reason, the main reason they gave as to why they refused to publish it, first of all?
There wasn't really a reason. I'm guessing it was just, well, partly probably because they had no idea who I was.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd never heard of me. And it might have been a risk, but I honestly don't know why they said no. Maybe they had enough advent material. I don't know. But anyway, that's another thing I don't need to know.
Yet again, you refused to give up. You believed in something. And despite everything, you went for it. Sort of a very Erin Brockovich type sort of thing, if you know your films, and based on a true story as well.
I do actually know that story. I don't know my films, but I do know that one.
Well, it's true. You decided to go for it regardless, get it published. And the end result now is that you've written many, many more books, which is fantastic.
I should just also point out that I had an excellent selling team. In the shape of my parents.
Oh, wonderful.
They also took the book into shops and things, so it wasn't just me.
Oh, wonderful. See, this could make a great film. I could just see it, you know, through the eyes of your parents, how they had, you know, had to go around to all the Christian bookshops and broker a deal.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
The other thing is then, writing another book, I did make mention of this at the very beginning, that at the age of 21 you became deaf, and then eventually you wrote a book about your own personal journey, covering topics such as self-image, self-worth, loss, faith, and mental health. That book is called My Diary. What made you decide to write that? Tell us more, please.
Well, yes, My Diary is a sort of, as you say, it's my story. But I also wrote a book called Still Emily, which is also my story. They're written slightly differently. My Diary is aimed at younger people. Still Emily is my memoir. I have to say, neither of those books were ever going to be written. So when the publisher first took the 30 Days with Mary book on, they said, we also want your story, my own personal story. And I said, well, that's never going to happen because I'm never going to write it. So they said, well, okay, we'll still take the 30 Days one, the Mary's story. But my story was never going to be written. Throughout the following 20 years, people periodically said, we'd like you to write your story. Publishers that I met, people that I met said, you should write your story. And I said, it's never going to happen, never going to happen. And then eventually God said to me, it's probably time. So that's when I wrote my memoir. That's when I wrote Still Emily.
Ah.
I actually reread Still Emily recently. It was published in 2015. I don't sit and read it every night. I haven't even read it since, you know, it was published and that's fine. But I reread it because it's going to be published in a new font.
Wow.
Which is specific for people with dyslexia, which will be great if that will help people read. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a font that's been especially developed for people who are dyslexic. So I reread the book to see if there was any tweaks or changes that needed to be made. And as I read the book, I did think, I wonder how I put that together, because it's obviously putting your story together is quite difficult, but God really helped me. The My Diary one, as I say, it was for younger people, because young people go through so many difficulties, and I wrote it so that they could, I guess, feel less alone. And actually, recently, I had a letter from a girl who is, I think, 10, and she had read the book and she'd written to me, and she herself has health challenges. In a nutshell, I think for her just to read a story of somebody who got it, who understands, who also doesn't have a squeaky perfect life, I think was really helpful for her. And it was just, I think, realising, though I'm not sure she'd have actually put it this way, but realising that everything doesn't always have a happy ending. You know, my story is not, as we've talked about, is not, oh, yes, I was ill, but I'm healed and everything's fine. I was ill, I'm still ill, and God is with me in it, and he helps me get through. And this girl was experiencing the same thing. So I think there's something about my story that isn't a healing story, that actually helps people who themselves are going through difficult things, and actually there's no end in sight. But you know, they realise they're not alone. So yes, I think that's something about the book.
I think that's brilliant. A 10-year-old bothered to write to you. I think that's an incredible testimony to your skills in writing. And the fact that you can just put across information that people of all ages can pick up on. And like you say, it's a Barnabas moment. That girl was encouraged and encouraged you in return.
Yeah, mutual Barnabasing.
Yeah.
Actually, I think Barnabasing is quite a good word. We should invent that, shouldn't we?
Yes, well, we just have. To Barnabas, it's a verb.
To Barnabas.
It's a very good verb. Mental health and loss of faith. Well, we've talked about loss of faith, but not so much mental health as much, or self-image or self-worth. In the remaining couple of minutes, which one would you like to just talk about from your perspective to encourage those that are listening today?
Possibly the image one, because actually my latest book that is not out yet, I submitted the manuscript, so it's not even edited yet. But for this one, my publisher said, what's really on your heart? What would you like to write about? The answer was identity. I know there's a lot of different identity words being thrown around at the moment, but the identity I meant is who we are in Christ, who we are in God. And so that is the book that I've written. I'm not sure when it will be out, but that is really important to me and has been really important to me. When going through my life, things have been taken away, abilities. You know, I can't do sport anymore. I can't do music anymore. I can't do various things, particularly actually the occasion I mentioned when I was at university and then didn't get my degree. That was huge for me because I realised that throughout growing up and school and everything, it's always aimed at getting a degree. And that had almost become part of my identity, although I hadn't realised that. But when I didn't get a degree and I went through the process of realising that a degree does not make me who I am. It doesn't make me have any more value. Identity is so important because we can learn that, as I say, it's who we are, not what we do, that really matters. So that is an issue that I'm quite passionate about, realising that who we are is more important than what we do.
That is a brilliant answer. And so let's just put it one step further. For those that are listening today who either have a lack of self-worth or a lack of self-image and worry about their own identity, or they've got an immediate relative or a sibling that they can then pass on your wise words you're just about to give us, what would you like to say to them?
From my own experience, I would say maybe try to look at yourself through God's eyes. Have I got time to tell a little story that made me sort of realise that?
Please.
I went to a National Trust place with my family years ago, after my damage. So my face was damaged and I was deaf and everything. And my little niece was in there. She was 18 months old. And we walked into a room. There was a ceiling to floor mirror. And she toddled in. She was holding my hand. And she stopped when she saw this mirror. And she was looking and she pointed at her own reflection. And she said, baby, baby. She was learning to talk. Baby, baby. And I looked where she was talking. And I saw Abigail, that's her name. I saw Abigail because that's how I know her. And I realised sort of in that moment and thinking about it afterwards that when I look at me, I see damage, damage, damage. But when God looks at me, he sees Emily because he knows me and he sees who I am. And so that's what I mean by learning to look as he sees us, rather than as we see ourselves. And you know, the Bible tells us how he sees us. He sees us as precious, special, loved, cherished, all these things. And we can't see it sometimes because we can't see it in ourselves. But if we say, okay, just for a minute, I'm going to look with God's eyes, then perhaps we can learn to really believe in who he made us to be.
Great answer. Thank you very much indeed. But I did say very briefly at the outset, what did you mean when you said I realised what silence means, what it actually means, not what my hearing self of yesterday had imagined it might mean.
Well, that is talking about when I had the surgery, which left me deaf, because I went into that surgery hearing perfectly, albeit in one ear, but hearing perfectly. Came out of that surgery, could hear nothing, because when they removed the tumour, they took my hearing. And so that's the time I'm talking about. So my hearing self of yesterday, day before surgery, deaf self after surgery. What I meant by that was, in the lead up to my surgery, which caused me to lose my hearing, I tried to rehearse what it might be like. So I would put my fingers in my ears to practice having silence. But you can always hear a little bit, even when you've got your fingers in your ears. Or I would watch television but press mute and see what that was like.
Yes.
But I always knew I could turn the sound back on and I'll be able to hear it. So what I meant by realising what silence is actually like, I meant, A, it's nothing, literally nothing. I could hear nothing. And I couldn't turn the sound back on. That's what I meant by realising it. I was stuck with it. And I realised that silence can be scary.
So how do you overcome the silence?
Well, as I say, one thing, looking for these rainbows, determinedly, even from the rubbish, because I felt like my life was surrounded by rubbish. I was still going to find a rainbow. Even when we're in the rubbish, we can find a rainbow. And I did that. And I overcame it by, I honestly don't know, just taking, I was going to say a day at a time, not even a day at a time, a step at a time, literally moment by moment by moment. I overcame it, I would say, by learning not to beat myself up. Not to get really angry with myself when I misunderstood something, or I was sitting in silence and I was terrified, or I was thinking I should just get a grip and get on with it. I learned not to do that. I learned to give myself a bit of a break and acknowledge that life is really hard and my life is really hard and I don't need to pretend it's not. Even when I'm finding rainbows, I don't need to pretend life is fine.
I'd like to take a very famous quote by Sir Winston Churchill that has meant a lot to me in my sort of Christian journey, especially going into radio broadcasting, and put a tag on by a certain Emily Owen, if that's all right. And I think this could be your manifesto motto for when you become Prime Minister.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So here goes the quote, all right? This is a mashup between Emily and Winston.
Wow.
Never, never, never give up and always look for rainbows.
Oh, brilliant. Yes, yes. And I would also add,
go for it.
Giving up can look like different things for everyone. So often it will look as though I've given up when I'm just lying in bed. But actually what I'm doing is I'm saying, I'm not giving up, but I'm acknowledging that my health means I need to stay in bed today. So, yeah.
Well, you can't hear me applauding, but I'll show you. I'm applauding. A great answer. Thank you so much. Emily, we've now come to the last question, unfortunately, because time has beaten us and you've got a photo shoot to go to. So I'm not going to stop you from looking absolutely fabulous.
Probably please keep talking so I miss the shoot.
So, final question then. Emily Owen, who is your Christian hero, please?
Actually, can I have two?
Yes, you can.
Okay, so the first one, I'm going to say my granny.
Wonderful.
My granny, she's now with Jesus. But she was a wonderful lady of faith. I remember her, you know, when she was, I don't know exactly how old, but to me she was quite old. She was a little lady, little Scottish lady, and she would go into Leicester Prison and she would spend time with the prisoners, sharing her faith, talking to them, and this kind of thing. She would volunteer in the hospital. Anyone she met, she would share Jesus. Her life of faith was a real example. So she is, I would say she's one of my heroes.
I love it when people choose people no one's ever really heard of, and in this case is your granny. So let's have a big shout out, please, to your granny. What was your granny's name?
Her name was Helen Luck.
L-U-C-K.
L-U-C-K, yes. That was her name. And She was wonderful. So yeah, I'm so glad now that she's getting a shout out on here. Thank you. So my second one that I'm going to say is Horatio Spafford. You may or may not have heard of Horatio Spafford.
I have.
He wrote that hymn, It Is Well With My Soul.
Yes.
He wrote that hymn, It Is Well With My Soul, when he'd actually discovered that his children had died. He found that place that even in the midst of, I guess what I've been taught, calling rubbish, but even in that hard place, he realised that it can be well with my soul. And that is a bit what I was talking about earlier about identity, who we are, learning that deep down it can be well, even though all around is hard. That hymn, because I can still hear it in my head. I have to have MRI scans every year to check my tumours and how they're doing or not doing. I don't like those scans. I don't know if you know what scans are like, but you have to lie in a tube and it's just not very nice. What I do is I sing to myself, it is well with my soul. There's a line that says something like, the trials come, the things are difficult, the things are really hard. It doesn't say that at all, but that's the essence of it. The things are difficult, it is well with my soul. And I've learnt the truth of that. So Horatio is a real help to me. So yeah, he's one of my heroes.
And I think the story of Horatio is that he was from the United States of America in the late 1800s.
Yes.
And if I remember rightly, he was about to board a boat to come over to Europe, and he suddenly got a telegram or something to go back and sort out an important piece of business. So he put his family on the boat and said, I'll catch the next boat.
Yes.
The ship, either collided with another ship, or whatever happened, somewhere in the Atlantic, it sank. And he had three daughters, was it? That drowned? Did his wife survive? I can't remember.
Yes.
It was something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's like his wife survived. And I believe he received a telegram telling him about this. After I've spoken to you, I'm going to Google, actually, because I can't remember what the telegram said, but I know it's something like saved alone or something like that from his wife. But then he got on the boat to go and join her. Yeah, he literally sailed over the place where his daughters died. And he found that place of it is well with my soul, which I think is just incredible.
Yes, I think the captain of the ship actually knew what had happened to Horatio and called him up onto the deck so he could be told this is roughly where the ship sank. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Is that what happened? Oh, thank you. I didn't realise that.
I think so. It's just that somebody else chose Horatio many, many moons ago. So I do remember that story. But he did. He wrote, it is well within my soul as a result of it.
And that's interesting that somebody else chose him.
But also, I think Granny Luck, that is a cracking story to end with as well. She was prepared to go into prisons, just encourage those prisoners. And who knows, maybe one day someone will be listening to this podcast and say, well, I remember Granny Luck. She talked to me in prison and the result of it, blah-de-blah-de-blah. So if you know someone like that, please let us know, because it'd be great to follow up that story.
Wonderful. Just on the off chance that somebody is listening to this who remembers her, can I just say to you that my granny absolutely loved visiting you. It was one of the biggest privileges of her life.
Well, if that isn't a rainbow moment, I don't know what is. Emily Owen, thank you so much for sharing today. It's been an amazing time, and enjoy your photo shoot later on today.
I will try and enjoy the photo shoot, but I don't think I'll enjoy it as much as this conversation. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Emily. Cheers. God bless. Bye. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
And he said, look, if you're interested in Birmingham, I know the place you should go. It's Winston Green. All the things Ange you're doing in social enterprise and community development, you could do that at Winston Green. And we're going to be taking over a failing government school. You can be based in that school, get to know everybody. It's on a street that will become quite famous in 2014. A documentary series is being made about it called Benefit Street. You'll be right in the epicenter of all that. And so, yeah, so it did feel like actually the same as Springvale and Clontoy. These places kind of chose us more than we chose them. Now, none of our plans survived impact in lots of ways, and we've had to start everything again. But those invitations and that opening and that sense of we were home, this is where we're supposed to be, has been really important. I always kind of joke, there's always the ideal of what it's going to be like, then there's the ordeal, and then if you hang around, sometimes you get the new deal. And that's been true for us here in Winston Green.
So please join me and our very special guest, Dr. Ash Barker, for the next episode. Until then, cheerio.